Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
It's Mitch Albom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Mitch, you've been a musician, you're a writer, of course, you founded charities, you run an orphanage in Haiti, but I suppose what you're best known for is your book, Tuesdays with Maury, and it remains one of the best-selling memoirs ever, and the stage show is coming to Ireland next month. Maybe before we come to Maury and how he changed you, will you paint a picture of the kind of guy you were before you met Maury?
I was what they define here as type A. I worked about 90 hours a week. I worked as a sports journalist, as a sports writer, broadcaster on TV, radio host. I never said no to anything that was offered work-wise because I thought they wouldn't ask me again. And I was pretty much wrapped up in myself and not really thinking a whole lot about helping others or the community or really the significance of life. I was in my late 30s and you know, at that age, you sort of feel, impenetrable and very powerful. And then I happened to flip on the television one night, and there's a program here late at night called Nightline. And there, it's normally a news program, but there on the TV screen was a thin, sickly, white-haired version of my old college professor, Maury Schwartz, who I had been extremely close to while I was in college 16 years earlier, and then had lost touch with as I went out to, you know, seek my ambition. And here he was on television talking about what it was like to die from motor neuron disease. And that was the first I even knew about it or heard about it, and everything kind of changed after that.
And you decided to go and see him. Had he meant a lot to you in college?
We were extremely close. I remember a funny story. The very first day of classes of college for me, I had signed up for his class, didn't know who he was, walked into the classroom, and there were 9 kids in the classroom. And being kind of a typical freshman, I immediately said, now this is way too small a class. If I cut it, they're going to know I'm not here. You know, I wanted a real big class, so in case I slept in late or something, I wouldn't get in trouble. And so I was actually leaving. You know, I sort of turned around and left, was going down the hallway to drop the class, because you can drop a class if you signed up for it and signed up for another one. And he started to call roll. And I heard my name, Mitchell Albom, you know, because, hey, you know, you're the first name on the list. And I could have sort of kept going because he didn't know it was me, but I felt guilty. And so I kind of slid into the room and I said, here. And he said, is it Mitch or Mitchell? Which do you prefer? And I'm sure that doesn't mean anything to you, but to me, I was kind of grateful that he asked that because I have one of these names, Mitch, Mitchie, Mitchell, you know, it depends on what people want to call you. So I said, well, my friends call me Mitch. And he said, all right, Mitch it is. And Mitch, and I said, yeah. He said, I hope one day you'll think of me as your friend. So I knew cutting the class was out of the question at that point, you know, but that began this really amazing relationship. I took every class that he offered. I majored in sociology because of him. I wrote my honors thesis with him. We walked around campus together. We had lunches together. I went to his home. He was really more like an uncle to me than a teacher. And on the last day of school, graduation, I brought him a briefcase as a gift, and I'd never gotten a gift for a teacher before in my life. And I'm sure it was a very cheap briefcase because I didn't have any money. But he took it around like it was a brick of gold, and he said, you know, Mitch, you're one of the good ones. Promise me you'll stay in touch. And I said, I will. He said, promise. I said, okay, I promise. He said, say it in a sentence. I said, okay, I promise I'll stay in touch. Maury, I promise I'll stay in touch. And then I broke that promise for 16 years, as we often do when we get involved in our lives and our ambitions and our hurry, hurry, hurry careers, until that night when I saw him and found out that he was dying.
And was it guilt that you decided to go and see him? Or were you looking for something from it, do you think?
Well, Brendan, the answer that makes me look better would be the latter and say, yes, I was looking for something meaningful. But the honest answer is probably more guilt.
Yeah,
I felt guilty that I had lost touch with him. I felt guilty that he was dying. and I was healthy. You know, I called him up. At first, all I was going to do was make a phone call. And I dialed his number. And when I was in college, I used to call Maury Coach, like a sports affectation. You know, hi, Coach. How you doing, Coach? That kind of thing. And I had long since forgotten that over the 16 years. But I called his number, and a nurse answered, and she handed him the phone. And I still remember, I said, when I heard his voice say hello, I said, "Professor Schwartz, this is Mitch Albom. I was a student of yours in the 70s. I don't know if you remember me." And the first thing he said to me after 16 years, "How come you didn't call me Coach?" And so, needless to say, by the time the conversation was over, I was coming to visit him, because guilt is a very powerful motivator. And I went to go visit him one time. Again, I thought it would just be a one-time visit. But I was so taken during that visit by, even though he was in a wheelchair already, couldn't use his legs anymore, his arms were shaking, and he could barely lift a fork to put a piece of tomato into his mouth. And then once he got it in his mouth, it took a long time for him to chew it. You could just see his body was deteriorating right in front of me and losing the ability to use his extremities or his muscles. And yet he never complained. He just talked about all the brilliant things that he was seeing as he was dying, and people who were coming to visit him, and how he was kind of like a leaf at the end of its life that becomes brilliant colors. And, you know, when I finally went home, I ended up, you know, canceling flights until the last one of the day. And having spent hours there, I flew home and I said, "You know, you're 37, you're perfectly healthy, and he's 78 and he's dying, and he seems happier and more content with his life than you are. And there's something the matter with this." And that's when I decided to go back, as he had asked me, "Would you come back and see me again?" So I went the next Tuesday. And then when that finished, he said, "How about you come next Tuesday?" And I said, "Okay." He said, "How about you come all the Tuesdays after that?" And I said, "Okay, Maury, I will." And that's how Tuesdays with Maury came into being.
So tell me about the conversations. What were the most important things you learned from him?
Well, we started out, you know, just sort of talking about his disease and what he was learning. But very quickly, it sort of evolved into a last class of what's really important in life once you know you're going to die. Not when you think you're going to die, like we all sort of think one day we're going to die, but when you're looking death in the face, what puts everything into perspective that, you know, you can say this matters, this doesn't matter, you think this matters, but when you get to the end, it's not going to matter. And each week we sort of took a subject and broke it down like that. And I mean, amongst the weeks that we talked about family, we talked about culture, we talked about money, we talked about forgiveness, we talked about, you know, what's a perfect day on earth, charity, I mean, you name it. And you know, by the time we were done, I chronicled in the book, Tuesdays with Maury, 16 Tuesdays, I think, or 14 Tuesdays. And there were many others. But, you know, we sort of did this last class, you know, on the meaning of life.
So did his being close to death give him a clarity, do you think, that most of us don't have?
No doubt. And not just him. I think a lot of people get that. I'll give you an example. One time we turned on the TV. We very, very rarely looked at television during that stretch of time. I think he had an old black and white TV anyhow. But we turned it on and there was some footage, a news program from a war that was taking place, I think at the time in Bosnia. And Maury watched this and he began to cry. And I said, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "Well, it's just so awful, the suffering." And I said, "Well, it's awful, obviously, but have you ever been to Bosnia?" "No." Do you have friends there?" "No." "Well, why are you so moved that you're in tears?" That's a typical news report. And he said, "Mitch, when you're dying, you suddenly have this enormous empathy for anyone else who's suffering. And you understand what it means because you're close to death too." And I thought, wow, okay, we really shouldn't have to wait until we're dying to have that empathy. And I would say that kind of paradigm, that we shouldn't have to wait till we're dying to fill in the blank, that was pretty much in everything that we spoke about. He had a perspective on things about what really matters and what doesn't, that I think was obviously brought on by the fact that his days were numbered. and he knew that they were numbered, and he was watching, you know, such is the nature of motor neuron disease, or what we call ALS, that you can watch yourself deteriorate. You can go from, I could move my foot yesterday, now I can't move it. I could wiggle my toe, now I can. I could scratch my head, now I can't. And yet your mind stays perfectly intact, and you're aware of this. So you really are watching your time dwindle down. And I think that that puts things into a tremendous perspective.
Yeah. One of his lessons was, don't buy the culture. Explain that to me.
Well, we talked a lot about the things that we value, particularly in America. I imagine it's the same over there to a large degree. Work, money, status, success. And he said, I see a lot of people I have over my life, and I see them now, who come to me who are, you know, doing a lot, doing well, but not satisfied. And I think I was one of them, by the way, and he was kind of talking to me. And he said, that's because the culture teaches you, you know, this is where your status comes from, how big your house is, what car you drive, what kind of job you do. And the truth is, he said, if you don't like the culture, you don't have to follow it. You're not obligated to make someone else's values your values. You can live differently. You can choose to say, well, that's not what's important to me. You know, I have a different set of values, and it's all right, even if it's kind of counterculture. And that holds for, you know, the level of work that a person should do, or the amount of hours, the level of success that a person should be in order to be considered a success, the clothes that they should wear, how many friends that they should have on social media, you know, all these things that we sort of take as like the unofficial rules of being considered successful or cool or you know, enviable. And Maury really said, says who? And he was, you know, I remember at a basketball game once, they were chanting, we're number one, you know, for the team, the college team. And Maury stood up and said, what's the matter with being number two? He screamed at him. And that's kind of, you know, an example of how you can think a little differently than the culture you're in.
Yeah. How did those conversations with Maury change you, Mitch?
Well, at first, I think I was more just being observant. And then when I would see the way that he would cry over certain things or be moved over certain things, for example, one of the most moving things that we went through was when he told me the story about this friend of his who he had lost touch with. And they had had an argument over a silly thing about how the friend hadn't called when Maury's wife was sick. And when he did call, Maury was like, oh, now you call. And he was, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, it's a little late for that. And, you know, it turned into one of those little arguments and it split apart their friendship. And he started, Maury was telling me this, and he began to weep. I mean, weep, you know, like he couldn't even catch his breath. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, I found out last week that Norman, this guy, died from cancer a few months ago. He said, I never had the chance to make it up to him. Why did I let that foolish disagreement separate us for all these years? It means nothing to me now. All I wish is that I could hold his hand and tell him what a good friend he'd been for all those years before, but I can't and I never will. And he looked me in the eye and he said, Mitch, if there's anybody you care about or you love who you're fighting with or you're feuding with, let it go. Let it go. If you're 100% right and they're 100% wrong, just say that you're wrong, if that'll end it. Because when you get to where I am, and you will get to where I am, you're not going to care who is right or wrong. You'll just care that they're there with you, you know. Forgive everybody everything. And when I saw how upset he was that he had lost this friendship and that he felt so bad about not having forgiven, you know, I began to start to absorb that into my own life and the people that I had had maybe been having some disagreements with or hadn't spoken to for a while because I was angry at them or them with me. And slowly these things began to sort of take shape in my life. And I guess the biggest thing, Brendan, the first major turning point was when I asked him what he feared the most with his dying. And he said, you know, I thought he was going to say the way that he died or choking to death or whatever, but he said, I fear the debt I'm going to leave my family. And that's when I found out how in debt he was for his medical bills and how he didn't have any money to pay it. And the family was going to probably have to sell the house after he died. And he said, I'm going to die twice. Once when I die and once wherever I am, realizing that I'm causing my family all this financial distress. And so I had the idea to write a book to raise money for him. That was the only reason Tuesdays with Maury, the book, came into existence. I didn't go to visit him to write a book, but I thought, well, maybe there's a way. And I went around to a bunch of publishers and nobody wanted it. Everybody said, that's boring, it's depressing, you're a sports writer. But I kept pushing because, you know, I was desperate to try to help him. And we finally found one publisher 3 weeks before Maury died. And I was able to go to Maury and say, hey, listen, you know, I found a publisher who wants to publish a book about our visits. And he said, oh, wow, you know, that's wonderful. And I said, well, here's the best part. They're going to give us some money and I want you to take all the money and just pay off your bills. And, you know, he cried and it was a very special moment just between the two of us. But I really think, Brennan, that was maybe the first time that I had ever done anything that was really just for somebody else and not for me, you know. Wow. And I was learning, you know, right in front of him. And of course, it turned out to be maybe the biggest thing that changed my life, but it was just done as a labor of love. And so from that point forward, I think everything kind of turned.
Maury talked a lot about family and children, and you and your wife didn't have biological children. But tell me about the orphanage in Haiti and the 60 children that you care for there.
Yeah. Well, my wife and I got married kind of late, you know. We were in our late 30s, almost 40 when we got married, and it didn't happen for us to have children. My wife really wanted them, and we kind of thought, well, that's one prayer that's not going to be answered. And then in 2010, the earthquake in Haiti, the terrible earthquake in Haiti that killed 3% of the population in 45 seconds, happened. And a pastor came to me in Detroit, where I live and work, and I do I write a newspaper column and do a radio program. And he asked if he could come on because he had an orphanage in Haiti that he thought had been destroyed and he couldn't make a phone call through. There weren't any phone lines. And he wanted to try to raise money to go down and see if anybody was alive. And so I helped put together this very quick effort and managed to get a small plane that we leased. And we flew into Haiti 3 weeks after that earthquake happened and went to this orphanage, which, thank God, had not actually been destroyed. A building next door to it had. It was overrun with people who were hoping for food or water or anything. And I sort of fell in love with the kids that were there and their amazing faith and their joy and their ability to be so resilient in the face of just awful death and destruction and poverty. I mean, they were eating one cup of rice a day, you know, but they were so happy that I was there and the visitors we had. And I began to go back the next month. The next month, I bought a bunch of guys from Detroit, which is kind of a blue-collar place and with a lot of people who are carpenters and plumbers and electricians and roofers. And we built the first toilets that orphanage had ever had. We built the first shower that they had ever seen. We built the first kitchen. We built a school. And as all this was going on every month, I saw that the kids were still starving. And the pastor finally admitted to me that he was in his mid-80s and that he didn't have any money to run the place. And he hadn't for a long time. And he was too old to really handle it. And I sort of blurted out in one of those moments that you later in life look back on and say, what were you thinking? And I said, well, I run some charities in Detroit. I could probably run this place if you want me to. And he basically said, thank you, Jesus. Hallelujah. Here it is. And he left and we basically never saw him again. And so I kind of inherited an orphanage and having never had children, I made pretty much every mistake that a man could make, but the children were never mistakes and they were brilliant. And, you know, these were kids who, gosh, some of them were left under trees to die, you know, out in the woods, nobody, you know, just no names, no birth certificates. Some were left in holes in the ground in villages that got overrun with flooding or hurricanes. Some were dropped off at tuberculosis centers and nobody ever came back for them. In many of them, we had to make up birth certificates and names and ages. And as the years have passed, I mean, it's now 14 years, and I've been there every single month of my life.
And you just came back in the last few days. And obviously, I mean, Haiti is such a kind of a troubled, feels like a cursed place in many ways. And now the current unrest there has been taken over by gang rule. How are things at the orphanage in Haiti right now?
Well, it's very dangerous. And we had to be airlifted, helicoptered out in the middle of the night just to try to get out because all the airports, as we're speaking, the airport are closed by the gangs. The roads are closed by the gangs. The ports are closed by the gangs. You can't get in by sea, by air, by road, by border. And the only people who are getting out are people who are able to arrange kind of middle of the night helicopters that don't get shot at. And we had to do that just a day before I'm speaking to you. And so the country is in absolute disarray and turmoil and chaos. We hear gunfire every night outside our orphanage, things burning, and hear stories about people being, you know, just lying in the street dead. Some of them are citizens who were killed by gangs. Some of them are gang members who were killed by vigilantes. And there's no government. There's no sense of order. The prime minister resigned, but there's nobody taking his place. So there's literally nobody in charge of the store, basically. And yet our kids remain incredibly resilient. And we have 60 children there currently. And we have 40 staff members. And they somehow manage to laugh and play and go to school and take care of each other and pray every night. They have this wonderful thing called devotions, which every night at about 7 o'clock, all of them from the 6-month-olds to the 19-year-olds gather in this gazebo and just sing hymns and prayers and whatever without any books or papers because they know them all by heart and just say thank you to God for what they have. And I mean, everything they own and have fits into a single 12-inch by 12-inch cubby, yeah. And yet they're so grateful, you know.
That's a bit of perspective for the rest of us too. Mitch, would you tell me about someone else who is very important in your life? And is it Chica?
Yeah, Chica. Well, Chica was one of our kids from Haiti. She was born 3 days before the earthquake, and when she was 3 days old, she was in a little cinder block structure, and the earth shook and it came down around her, but the roof was made of tin and was just laying on top of it. So it fell backwards and she survived amazingly this earthquake when she was 3 days old. And her mother died 2 years later, giving birth to a baby brother. I mean, there was no doctor present and she started to bleed and there was nobody to take care of her. So Chica lost her mother the day her baby brother came into the world, and a godmother got a hold of her and brought her to our orphanage. And so she was a very loud, kind of obnoxious little kid, to be honest, but very brave and very pushy. And we just loved her because she was so, you know, brash. She was like, I said, Ethel Merman in size one shoes, you know. you could hear her across the yard. But she was fine, you know, like that until she was 5 years old. And then she developed a brain tumor. And we ended up bringing her to America thinking, well, the doctors, you know, get rid of this tumor, whatever it is, and she'll go back to Haiti and pick up being a kid. And she never went home. It turned out to be a stage 4 cancerous tumor called DIPG, which is always fatal. And we ended up adopting her, and they told us she'd be dead in four months. But we said, well, you don't know how tough this kid is. We're not believing you, and we're going to travel around the world if that's what it takes to try to find a cure for her. And she lived 2 years, you know, not 4 months, and 2 amazing years. And while we weren't able to find a cure, we did find a family. You know, it was as two people who never had children, and suddenly we have a child 24/7 under our care, sleeping at the foot of our bed and you know, waking us up and, you know, telling us what she wants to eat and all that. And it just became an amazing 2 years that we were so blessed to have her with us. And we lost her at age 7, but she was an inspiration to everybody who came in contact with her. I wrote a book about the experience called Finding Chica. And, you know, that's because one time she was lying in bed, very kind of gentle and quiet, and she looked up at me and she said, and my wife, and she said, "How did you find me?" And I thought it was just such a poignant question to come, you know. Normally children don't have to ask their parents, "How did you find me?" But, you know, she watches the little cartoons, you know, where a lamb is lost in the woods, or Bambi is lost in the woods, and someone comes and find him. And that's how she thought of herself, you know. And yeah. She said, how did you find me? And so I always said that, you know, if I ever wrote anything about it, I'd call it Finding Chica. And we miss her to this day, but we realized that instead of asking, as I did when she died, I got very angry with God and said, you know, how could you take a child like that, you know? But I've come to sort of look at it as like, what did we do to deserve to be given a child like that, even for the brief 7 years that she was in the world? And, I realized in some ways that was an answer to the prayer that we had made, you know, 20 years earlier about having children of our own. The prayer was answered. It just was answered a little later than we thought.
Yeah. And look, Chica lived and she was loved, and that is important. And people say it about little babies who live for a much shorter life, but people will say that was a life that baby lived and was loved and loved, and that's it, isn't it? Mitch, you won't be aware that for us in Ireland right now, this week, there's actually a very special resonance around this conversation about Maury, right? Because there was a guy called Charlie Bird who died on Monday. And Charlie was one of the best known journalists in Ireland, right? And like Maury, Charlie had motor neuron disease. And you talk about Maury giving you that final lesson. So Charlie Bird conducted a final lesson for everyone and a profound conversation around his death. But he conducted it with the whole country. He turned his last lap into a kind of a conversation around love and friendship and helping each other out. And I think as well, facing mortality with grace and courage, it's an extraordinary act of generosity for someone to do, isn't it? To turn their death into something for other people.
That's right. Well, I you're so right, Brendan. And I saw that happen with Maury, as I'm sure it happened with Charlie Bird. I watched people come to visit him, other people on the days that I was there, and they would always try to cheer him up, try to tell him some funny stories, bring some pictures of their families or kids. But after, you know, 5 minutes, he would start asking them questions, and then more questions, and they would come out of his office in tears. And I would say, "What happened?" They said, "Well, I tried to cheer him up, but, you know, after a few minutes, he started asking me about my life." And so I started telling him, and then he started really asking, and I started really telling, and then he started, you know, and next thing I know, I was crying about my divorce or my love life or my job or whatever. And so I finally went to him and I said, "I don't understand. Like, these people come to comfort you and you turn it into a therapy session for them. Like, why don't you just say, let's not talk about your problems. Let's talk about my problems. Yeah. You've earned the right. You've got the biggest problem of all." And he looked at me as if I had stepped out of a spaceship. And he said, "Mitch, why would I take from people like that? Taking just makes me feel like I'm dying. Giving makes me feel like I'm living." And I never forgot that sentence. It's profound, you know, it's so simple. It even rhymes, you know, but it's true. You feel so much more alive when you give. And as you say, it's an act of generosity, but it's also an act of life. You know, as we're dying, what good does it do to make more money? What good does it do to you know, punch one more hole in something or buy one more stock or have one more accomplishment? What good does it do you?
But and I suppose then, when you think about it, Mitch, the thing is that we are all dying. Like, we're all dying at various paces. And I suppose that time is all we have. And so that maybe if we all realize, well, we're dying too, do we get that perspective then?
Well, you would hope if everybody looked at, you know, as Maury said, if you take every day as if there's a bird on your shoulder, and each day you get up, you ask the bird, "Is today the day I die?" And of course, every day of your life, the answer will be no, except one. But are you prepared if the bird says, "Yes, today's the day you're going to die"? are you going to say, oh, no, I can't, I haven't done this, I haven't done that, or are you going to say, well, that's all right, I've lived my life the way that I should have, and I don't have regrets because I didn't get around to, seeing my loved ones or being good to people or doing that charity work that I thought I was going to do or whatever. And you're content in how you've lived your life. So we should live every life. It's very cliched, I know, but I always say people get critical of things that are cliched or sentimental. And I always say, well, that's because they're true. You know, if you're constantly looking for something that's brand new and that nobody's ever thought of before, chances are it may not necessarily be true. But the fact that a lot of people have repeated it or said it or cried over it doesn't make it bad. And the truth is, if you live every day as if you're dying, you will be more content. And when the day comes that you actually do die, I'm sure Charlie Bird would say that and Maury would say it, you're much happier and at peace with how you've spent your time and your days.
And you know what? We can't be reminded enough of those simple, sentimental cliches / truths. So thank you, Mitch Albom. And Tuesdays with Maury is coming to the Gaiety Theatre and the Tourne Theatre in Dundalk in April, and to the Everyman in Cork and the Watergate in Kilkenny in May. And tickets are on sale now. Okay, Togamid Sosbiog, Fanagy Ling.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.